Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have David Rogier of Masterclass coming to us from San Francisco. How's it going, David?
Good. It is a pleasure to be here.
Are you braced for this heat wave that we're all entering for the next week or so? I think San Francisco is included in this. It's not always.
I am excited for it. It'll be a chance to be outside. I am excited for it.
We were talking before the call. I lived in SF for 20 years. And I, you know, there's those 4 or 5 days a year in SF that it's like legitimately warm, and even night times are warm. So it's kind of special, actually.
It is. And then once it's warm, the next day it is cold again.
Yeah, right. Good. Are you from SF or where are you?
I'm actually from Los Angeles originally. So I was born and raised down in Los Angeles.
Not a bad place either. I think Masterclass is getting close to being a household name or on its way towards it. But for anyone who doesn't know, what is Masterclass? What do you guys do?
What we try to make it is that anybody in the world can learn from the best. So we offer online classes from the absolute best in the world. So you can, you know, learn how to shoot the ball from Steph Curry, filmmaking from Martin Scorsese, how to sing from Christina Aguilera. It's online classes from the best in the world.
It's really cool. Yeah, I was looking at these. I think I've got a 9-year-old daughter who's into gymnastics, and I think we were thinking about doing the Simone Biles gymnastics class for her birthday. So we might.
It is an amazing class. And I think the part that makes it really, really neat is not only the class on gymnastics and technique and form, but she also talks about life and how to approach it, and how she trains, things that apply to everyone, not just a future gymnast.
Yeah. She's inspiring even to a 48-year-old white dude in Marin. I think she's pretty cool. So damn, I'd like to watch that. Very interesting. I feel like you're part of a meta trend. We had Cameo on this show, which is doing, you can hire celebrities, a little bit more like third tier celebrities to do birthday shout outs. We had Omaze, which is doing these celebrity charity things. And you know, it's really interesting how there's this industry of celebrity. Where'd you come up with this idea?
I was getting my MBA. And I had a instructor who was brilliant and great. And I was talking to him about career advice and what I should do after school. And I came to him one day and I was like, hey, Michael, I think I found my next job. And he's like, oh, David, great. What? I was like, well, that next job kind of involves you. And he's like, wait, what? And I was like, what if I come work for you? I will help you invest in startups. Because he ran a big venture capital firm here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, just to teach at school, you know, to help give back. And he said yes. So after school, I went and worked for him. I was investing in startups. And after a while, I'll be honest with you, Nathan, I didn't like it that much.
Yeah.
And so I went to him and I was like, Hey, thanks. But you know, I'm going to quit. I think there's a little bit of shock and surprise. And he's like, what are you going to do? I was like, I'm going to go start something. And he's like, what? I said, I'm not sure. And he's like, why don't you ask me for funding? I was like, wait, what? I don't have an idea or a team. He's like, ask me. I was like, okay, I would love some funding. And he goes, deal. And he invested just under $500,000 and basically said, I need to go think of an idea. It was amazing. I was honored. I was thrilled. And Nathan, I was terrified.
Uh-huh, sure.
All within the span of, you know, 10 seconds. It seems like a great opportunity, a amazing gift and chance. And it was, but I also felt immense amount of pressure.
Yeah.
I knew this was a once in a lifetime chance. I did not want to mess it up. There's no right way to think of a great idea. There is no proven way to do it. Everybody has their own ways to approach it.
Yeah.
And it actually became a dark time in my life.
Interesting.
I probably spent a year. And the reason it became dark is you feel the self-imposed responsibility or pressure. And you can't complain about to anybody because you're not going to get any grain of empathy.
No.
Right? So you really can't complain about it. And, you know, it makes you think inside, you know, okay, what am I made of, right? And I tried all different ways to approach it, things that, you know, needs I have, trends you see, you know, things I have depth in. And, you know, you ask for lots of help and advice and thoughts, but sometimes that actually hurts you because everyone has their own opinion and thought.
Sure.
You kind of get lost in it. And I remember talking to somebody about it. She gave me an amazing piece of advice. She said, choose something that even if it fails, you are going to be proud of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a constraint, and I think there's a lot of power, of strength in, and to have some sort of limits or box or constraints. She said, you know, to having that constraint actually for me took all the ideas of how to optimize a sales force out of the window. And it made me think about what are the things that I really care about. And for me, it was education. So mm-hmm. I was in part raised by my grandmother. There's something I will never forget. I remember I was in second grade and I would come stay with her. And it was after school. So I got dropped off at her house. And I was complaining about all the math homework I had, which obviously, you know, in second grade, you do not have a lot of.
No.
And she says, I have a story to tell me, which like as a second grader is like the last thing you want to hear. And so she tells me this crazy story. So my grandmother was 16, lived in Krakow. She lived in Krakow in Poland. Her and her mom went on a family vacation. Dad's going to join, stays home a couple extra days to finish work. And while they're on vacation, the Nazis invaded. They took everything and they killed her father. Mm. She flees to New York City. Only job her and her mom get is on a factory floor. They're working side by side. My grandma decides she wants to become a doctor. Finds every medical school in the state of New York, applies to every single one by hand, right? This is before computers. She gets a no from every single one. Keeps working the factory, applies again next year. Gets a no from every single one. Starts calling the deans of admissions and asking, why am I not getting in? They all hang up on her, except for this one guy who says, I'll be honest with you. You have three strikes against you. You are a woman and you are an immigrant and you're Jewish. Hangs up the phone.
Hmm. Interesting.
She keeps working the factory, applies again next year, gets into one school and becomes a pediatrician.
Hmm.
And Nathan, I'm staring at her because at age eight, this is intense stuff to be hearing from just having complained about math homework. And my grandma tries to tell me, and what my grandma then says is, David, the point I'm trying to make to you is education is the only thing that someone can't take away from you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me. And she was my hero. And, you know, for me, what drives me is I don't want to be on my deathbed and hopefully a long period of time and think I didn't try to make the world a bit better. So with that constraint said, hey, can I make something other people can't take away from others? Can I make it possible for anybody to learn from the best?
Mm-hmm,
And that was the inkling of the seed for this idea. And so it's interesting how you framed it, because for us, it's not about star power or how famous somebody is. It is about mastery. Now there are some people the best in the world that are well known and household names and famous because of their mastery. But fame in itself is not what we look for. And then there are, of course, people on the site that you've never heard of who are amazing and wonderful instructors. And so for us, it actually is about that level of mastery.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an impressive collection, obviously. I don't need to tell you that. But just like Jane Goodall for conservation, Anna Wintour for creativity, like it's pretty interesting. So with that aha moment, I don't know if it was a lightning strike moment or more of a gradual evolution of, you know, selling mastery, so to speak. How did you start to collect or curate these masters and celebrities, frankly? Because that seems like that would be really hard. How do you
It was really hard. It probably took 8 to 10 months to get the first ones to say yes. I mean, I cold called, I said emails. you know, I mean, it was hustle and grind. You know, if somebody said that they are free in New York on Thursday, I was like, I'm going to be in town then. I wasn't planning to be in town, but I got a plane ticket and got in town, right? So, you know, it was that hustle and grind. It was hard. There were days and weeks where I doubted the idea. There were definitely days and weeks that lots of friends and advisors also had doubted the idea. But I think how I try to think about it was, you know, I just need one.
Yeah.
And I just need to start it with one. If I get one, I can then get two and then three and four. And then I started really thinking, hey, instead of thinking about what I need or want, let me try to be in their shoes and think what they need and want, right? And so when you start doing that, it changes the perspective a little bit, right? So you say, hey, if I'm a best in the world, right, and I'm a household name or I'm not, what things am I going to care about? Well, there's going to be a large group of those people that want to give back, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something back to teach. I think the intrinsic desire, you know, a thing will be there for the person. Two is they're going to care a lot about how they look on screen, how they are presented on screen, what is the brand around it, right? And so a thing that we did, which is just you do not hear of in the entertainment world or education world, is we gave them rights to approve their classes.
Mm.
You know, if you think about this in the entertainment world, an actor never gets to approve the movie, right? But this was about trust, right? And then thinking, you know, this is something that they're going to leave for the rest of their life. How do they make sure it's something that they're proud of?
Yeah, it's interesting. What a couple other little smaller questions on that, because still I think that's interesting for people trying to make a market, which is basically what you're doing. What was your pitch to them when you didn't have an audience to sell them? And who was your first person to say yes?
Yeah, I mean, my pitch is I'm gonna get them a large audience. So it had to be a little bit of faith.
Yeah.
The first person we filmed was James Pat, the author James Patterson.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, he's written 100 bestsellers, an amazing entrepreneur and author, cold emailed. You know, for him, there were people in his life that helped mentor him, that helped teach, and he wanted to give back. And then, you know, it was important for him that this was going to be a real thing and a high quality thing. So things that we did at that point was say, hey, how do I bring people onto the team or to help film it or direct it? That James is going to trust. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. And so the director for that shoot was a man by the name of Bill Gutentag, won 2 Oscars as a doc filmmaker. Right. He's been an advisor and a friend to us. It's been really amazing. But you know, I went and found Bill because, you know, if you could attract people like that, it's going to be more safe for anybody who wants to be involved. So I think the big thing I learned there is do not just think about it from what thing I want, right? Think about it. How do I frame it to that other person? It's going to be something that's going to appeal to them. And at that level, it is never money, right? So you have to appeal to all the other things, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you guys, so when someone says yes, you will get your film crew and come. Do you structure or create the course, or you let them create the course and you're just filming it? Yeah.
This is one thing we did really early on. We are very invested and involved in that class process and the grading process. You know, how we see our role is to take the view of the student. So we do tons of work to figure out what people want to learn from that. Then James or whoever else comes with, here's what I think people should learn, or here's what I wish somebody had taught me. And we then merge those two worlds. Now I'm going to stop here for a second. That might seem like a very basic thing to do, an intuitive thing to do. I remember going once to an ed tech event, and I mentioned this. There were gasps in the room. I was like, sorry, like what? I don't understand. In most traditional education, you don't ask the student what they want to learn. I mean, think about how many times in school were any of us ever asked, what is it you want to learn? Now, I don't think that's the only input, because there's also things that you don't know that you do not know, right? You don't know that you need to learn. But this idea that we're going to bring some of the consumer insights or the practices that we've learned in the business world to education, you know, is still a new concept.
Yeah, interesting. I recognize it's not these guys aren't driven by money. Most of them are probably just great. But is the model, is it a rev share model with them anyway, or is it purely just exposure? And also in the business model, it looks like it's $15 a month billed annually. Is that for all of them, or is it per lesson?
Yeah, so it's $180 it's $180 a year, and that's access to all the classes.
Okay.
So, this was an important thing to us, and that's not how we actually launch it. So when we launched a business, it was a single class. We then switched over to offering a subscription, offering for access to everything. And that we saw a change in user behavior, change in LTV, because what it ends up is there's always a field and a bunch of fields people want to go deep in. There's also brand new fields that they just want to explore.
Sure.
So one of the important things about Masterclass, and we have seen the stats, if you take the Steph Curry class as your first class, the classes you're going to take afterwards are Chef Ramsey, Steve Martin, right? So it's not that, I think this is a myth in society and education. So we're defined by one field or one thing. And actually, I think we are multi-hyphenate. I'm an entrepreneur, but I also love to plant, plants and as a photographer, and I like fish. And so I think what our company does is allow you to explore all of you and not just one area.
That's cool. That's news to me. I think when we were looking at Simone Biles, it was still per class. And so that's great that it's now, for all of it, because there's a lot of amazing stuff on here. And is it a rev share with the artists, or?
It is something that we do not disclose.
Okay. Yes, that's right. All right, we'll get to the fundraising, because this show is really about fundraising, but your business is so cool.
I have lots of thoughts about fundraising.
Yeah. So last question on this, how has COVID and pandemic affected? I'm assuming this is a very, COVID, getting a boost from COVID type of business, right? Or what?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a huge surge in sales and demand. It depends on the week, but there are some weeks it's up 1,000% year over year. So that part is great and wonderful, and we're seeing an increase in how much time people spend. We're seeing a change in what classes people take. So we actually seen a really large increase in the amount of people taking the class from Neil deGrasse Tyson on how to think like a scientist, which makes sense. Also a big uptick in people taking the class from Winter. If you think of Anna, of like how to be a boss, how to lead, that stuff has changed a lot in the past few months, and so we've also seen uptick there too.
Interesting. Yeah. Cool. And are those the two most popular classes? I was going to ask that too. Like, what are the two
it
most?
It totally depends on the week.
Yeah.
There is not like one that like super stands out. It just depends on the week.
Got it. Okay. Let's talk about fundraising. So, how much have you guys raised and over how many rounds?
We have raised to all combined over $240 million.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. And the most recent was a Series
E, that we close the first half of this year that was a $100 million round led by the folks at Fidelity.
Fidelity, yeah, interesting. Yeah. Let's go back though to the earlier days. You said earlier that you were kind of seeded with this $500K. What was the venture firm you're at?
Michael Deering at okay. Harrison Metal, which was the one that he created.
That was your seed, your angel.
Seed or angel. Yep.
And okay, cool. So maybe talk about those early days. It's, you got $500K to kind of explore this concept, and then when did you decide, all right, it's time to actually raise some real money, and how did you kind of put together an investor roster?
Yeah. I mean, every round is quite different, and the bar goes up for every round, and what somebody looks for changes.
Yeah.
I in the beginning, right, in the first few rounds, it's a lot on vision. Mm-hmm. So you really have to frame what is it that you want to do? You know, we raised our, our seed after that and our A actually before launch.
Okay.
That is a rare thing to do. I think, you know, I'm sure everybody talks on here on these podcasts, right? About when is the right time to actually raise. If you can, right? And it's not, you can't always, depends on the idea, depends on you, team, you know, the investor, all this. In the beginning, I always prefer to raise on vision than on metrics because your metrics out of the gate are never going to be great.
Sure.
And so you need enough money and funds to be able to have the time to actually improve them. So if you can, you try to raise beforehand. The really tough part about that is, right, there are a bunch of investors who be like, I'm not investing in you up until I see if it actually works. Right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Or if they do invest, the price is really going to be worse. So one of my tricks or hacks or my approach to that is, what things can I do before launch that will help drop the risk? So for example, if you think about the risks for our business, are we going to be able to sign any of these people to actually teach? Right? Are you going to be able to afford any of the deals? Are you going to be able to make classes that are good? Are people going to actually want these classes?
Yeah.
Right? All things like that. So I try to devise experiments and tests where I could get some answers to those even before launching. So for example, you know, to sign an instructor. Okay, well, I can sign an instructor before launch. That actually I have to do. But if I can prove before funding that I got a few yeses, that's going to answer that question, right? Two, you know, how do I prove I can make a really good class? Well, I need the funding to make a class, but I could do a test class. So we actually got my parents to film a test class, right? I did not pay them, right? They did that for free, right? But, you know, wanting to see if we could do it. On demand side, we did polls, right? And surveys and, you know, things that then, so when I went into the, you know, to actually pitch for the seed, it was, you know, I could paint a picture of where I was going and I could show all these test results, which A, reduce risk. Two, it also, I think, sends a sign to the potential investor, hey, this is somebody who understands risks, is trying to solve it, is scrappy. All really good signs, I think, for an investor.
That's great. I think, I mean, I don't know how many startups, because I deal with them all the time, who are stuck in that void of, hey, we've got this vision, we don't have metrics, we're in this void of like, if you give us money, we can build this, you know, and they're stuck trying to get out of that valley. And so this is good for that. That's great. How different was the pitch back at that seed round? Was it, you know, we're going to assemble like the world's greatest masters, or has it stayed true to, or was it a different pitch?
Yeah, it's a good question. The core idea has stayed the same. There's a lot of how we executed and what we did or results that we did not expect or anticipate. You know, early on, we always wanted to go to a subscription kind of, you know, mode. That wasn't what we talked about a lot in the first pitches, right? Because, you know, that was still far off. We needed enough classes, et cetera, right? So that became a very large part of the business. You know, one thing we did not anticipate was instructors would then really want to be on our site and on the platform, right? As you build a brand of really high quality stuff, people want to learn that would attract that. That wasn't something that we really thought of, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the core idea stay the same, but, you know, different aspects of it. And then the pitch has fundamentally changed, right? So in the seed pitch, it was me, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was me talking to investors. I'm selling them. It was just me at the pitch, right? Yeah. They're spending a lot of time to get to know me, to check on me, other people that have worked with me, et cetera. At the Series E that we just did, you know, it was me and our finance team. Mm-hmm. Most of the time isn't spent with me. Most of the time is spent with our finance team, because at that stage or that growth stage, I can have all the hustle, charm, and vision I want, but if the numbers aren't there, they are not investing.
Interesting. I want to come back to that, because I think we haven't got too many folks that had a bunch of B rounds, but not many like E rounds. So I want to come back to tips for pitching at the E round.
Yeah.
But let's stay with the sort of early days. So seed and A, vision. Now is B round kind of like, all right, here's vision plus some metrics. You know, maybe talk about putting that round together.
Yeah. So the B round was, so we did the A round probably about 8 months before launch. It was led by the folks at Javelin, who are fantastic and great. The B round we did a couple months after launch, led by NEA, also great. that there was traction, right? So there's some traction, so they respond to it. But you know, if I'm being straight, right, and honest, our stats were a mess, right? It was a couple months after launch. We did not have good dashboards, right? I mean, you're still trying to understand things. Every input is a signal. You're trying to figure out if this is important or not. So I actually remember in the B round, what we loved about the fund we went with, and yeah, it was a bunch of things, but one was they actually helped us prepare our deck. If you think about that, that is crazy. Why would a venture capital firm who wants to get in on the deal help you prepare a deck that you're going to show other people, right? Sure. But there was two reasons I think for it. One is, you know, we hadn't prepared a deck for that stage. And so they were great and be like, hey, look, you probably want to like show this stat too and this stat. You guys forgot this. And you're like, oh shoot, that was a really good idea. In that, so A, it was stuff that they I'm sure want to see, but B, it built trust because you see how they think about things. You see that they actually want to help. It's not just about winning the deal, but they want to help. And that builds trust. And, you know, I have a lot of thought on how you pick investors, but I think that to me was a really great sign.
Is that because they had already kind of, even if they haven't given you a term sheet, they already sort of said yes in their own minds that they're willing to do that? Or was it purely?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I do think investors very beginning in the process have an intuitive sense if they're going to potentially be interested or not. Mm-hmm. This is why if an investor doesn't show interest or isn't interested, I don't think you're ever going to argue with them and convince them to actually invest. And because I think intrinsically they either are interested or not, they then are going to look at the stats to make the call and decision. But I think they had that first instinct to your point, Nathan, of like, hey, this is something that is interesting to us because of the space, because of the team, attraction, but they then want to see the stats.
Let's drill into what you just sort of mentioned about, you know, thoughts or tips for picking the right investors. What are your thoughts on that? Yeah.
Okay, I have lots of thoughts here.
Go, let it flow.
One of the worst things that you can do as a company is have a bad board. Having bad investors or a dysfunctional board is going to kill you. Mm-hmm. It is going to introduce pain in your life. It's going to introduce stress in your life. It's going to slow down how fast you can operate. It's going to take up tons of your time. You're not going to enjoy it. And I saw this from friends from investing. So one of the most important things to me in picking an investor was choosing somebody who's going to be a good board member. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, once somebody invests, they aren't going to go away. Mm-hmm. So it is easier to get a divorce than it is to like get rid of a big investor, right? Mm-hmm. There is no easy means to do that. So what that means is for me, right? And everybody's different. What matters to an investor? I want somebody who is gonna be a collaborative partner, right? Mm-hmm. That means they're going to help, they're gonna give advice, I'm gonna be able to learn from them, but also they're gonna be a respectful partner, they're gonna be good to work, they're gonna be easy to work with. So I will do a tremendous amount of work before, you know, wanting to choose an investor. I know we were in a spot where we had choice, right?
Yeah.
But do a tremendous amount of work to figure out what is that person like? And things to do, right? The number one thing you should do is back channel. Mm-hmm. You want to talk to other entrepreneurs that they are on the board of. You can ask them for ideas, entrepreneurs, and they will share some, but those aren't the important ones. The important ones are ones who they aren't providing you, right? That you have to go find. And what you really want to find out and is entrepreneurs that they invested in or on the board of that their company failed or did not do well. Mm-hmm. It's easy when a company is doing well to be nice and great. The real test is when things aren't going well. How do they act? Yep. And look, you'll easily figure this out after talking to a few entrepreneurs. You talk to entrepreneurs where stuff went wrong, and they're like, "Look, I had a board that was mad at me, was upset, but this person was great. They were really helpful and helped me guide through it. Or, you know, I want to take money from them again," right? And, you know, sometimes entrepreneurs are do not want to talk about this when you back channel. So some questions I've learned, right, and I got from other people to ask was like, you know, to tell me about a time that you did not agree with them on something and you see how they acted. Are they yelling? Are they going behind your back or what? Two is what are the things that frustrate you about this person, right? You're just trying to figure out how they kind of work. So what usually then happens is the investors that offer you the best terms are the ones you least likely want to work with.
Oh, interesting.
So maybe not every round, but in a lot of rounds, we actually didn't choose the best terms. We chose the best investor because that extra 10% on price or whatever it is, to me, is not worth it. Any day of the week, I will take a great investor over optimizing on the best price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah. Very good. And tips for finding founders that there were the investors on the board of that failed. Is this just Googling and searching through Crunchbase and stuff like that? Or
On Crunchbase is a great source. You can look at, the investor will always put a page of of the companies.
Yeah.
And, sometimes they'll get rid of the ones that weren't as good, but you can find those. If you already have an investor and you're raising your next round, they often get intel and they're able to back channel because if they're on the same boards together, the other way, if you can't do it, is asking questions to try to get the stuff out of the investor. So for example, you can ask the investor, almost interviewing them right after they offer you a term sheet saying, hey, let's just say I have, I'm down our next quarter, right? Our sales are down, costs are up. What would you do? And you're just trying to get hints. Is the person going to be, rational? Are they going to think over the long term or not? So, just anything you can do to try to get a sense of that person.
Good. We could probably spend a long time on this, but any notable things you did different for C round and or D round? Should we skip over those, or are there some anecdotes learnings from those?
Our C and D was led by the folks at IVP. Mm-hmm. That we had already seen tons of traction, right? So that was, very different. It was all stats based. At that point, you're going to start to see this in the B, and for us, especially in the C, it now becomes much more important on the team. Right. And the team. And at that point, our team was still small. Our exec team was light. And so, I asked our board advice on it. Right. Cause I know at the C round, they care about that. And it was to be very upfront about it. Right. So I actually had a slide of like, here's what I want the team to be. And then here is where we are now. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is what I want help on. And this is what I'm doing about it. So, I think sometimes our instinct as entrepreneurs is to lean away from things that we're ashamed of or that we're behind of. I think you can kind of get ahead. You can, if you actually lean into it, it's a sign to the investors that you understand what the big risks are and you are tackling it. Right.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. I also think, beginning rounds, do whatever you can to not send decks. Every investor will ask for it. Everyone will push you to do it. I think it's very hard to get a yes from sending a deck beforehand because you miss the whole story, the arc, unless your traction is a traction of like Uber early on where every graph was just going up and up. It's so hard in a deck. And so I always try not to. Sometimes a person will not meet with you, right, unless you share a deck, but you can usually try to find ways around it.
If I'm the VC though, and I say, hey, love to set up a meeting, send over your deck. You just say, no, I'd love to just show it in person. Or how do you sort of dance around
that? Yeah. So they'll usually ask, hey, you want to send a deck? You can ignore that part of the note email from other stuff, saying, I'm putting together a demo to show, or, you still want to be polite. If they really push, you have to. Mm. I just found it in the ones I had to send the deck. I don't think any of them ended up even offering a term sheet because to me it was like they want to do a filter because they aren't that into the idea at first.
That's interesting. Yeah. I often tell founders just do like a teaser deck, which like problem, solution, market, team, and traction, where it's like four or five slides, just sort of broad strokes. But even that, I guess they could still use that as a filter. So yeah. Interesting. Okay. When did you bring on like I'm assuming you have a CFO or a true, because as you get progressively more, you're it's more about stats, about metrics. When did you start to build like the finance function and what did that look like?
The short answer is way too late. I should have done that a long time ago. We probably brought it on right after the C round. Should have done it a long time ago. I think a VP of finance, right, or something in that realm. You don't want, I think there's a risk of bringing it on really early. You don't want it before you start. I think even the C, the reason is the finance function is a great thought partner. Mm-hmm. They're going to think about metrics and stats. I think in the beginning, unless it's the right person, it can be totally the right person, right? And we have a great one that I love. But it's. I don't think you want that voice yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the really beginning stage, you want to find what things a customer loves. Mm. And you need to figure out that first, then start figuring out optimizing the whole model. So, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I would have probably brought one in around the B round, right? It's probably when I brought it around, you know, probably a year earlier, right, basically. Mm. But, you know, and then now, you know, I constantly wish we constantly have to grow our finance team because, it helps a lot.
So let's talk about, you know, tips and what it's like pitching Series E. I mean, Fidelity obviously is a huge, I think they're even pretty new to venture. I could be totally wrong about that, but they've been running their mutual funds forever, right? Like doing venture and growth capital is kind of newer. So what's it like pitching these guys? Yeah.
Yeah. So this E round was done during the pandemic. It was very early on in the pandemic. So it was still like new to pitch and to be pitched during the pandemic. That was weird. I mean, look, I'll be honest. That was weird, you know, to pitch people without having met them in person. It was a strange concept to me. I think, you know, definitely things I learned in that process of how to pitch over Zoom pandemic. I'm glad to share some of those lessons. Mm-hmm. I think you have to throw your traditional pitch out. Mm. To listen to a pitch over Zoom sucks. If you're talking for the full hour, God help you. I mean, just think about it. How many, for assuming that we are on as entrepreneurs, if somebody was talking at me for an hour, I mean, there's no way I can pay attention. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's just really hard over Zoom. So I think thinking of ways to break it up, to make it interactive, right? You know, we started with our pitch deck, you know, started in my routine of it, and I realized it's not working, right? So things I did, right? One is I just called it out. So I said, hey, look, this is, you know, I don't know how to pitch over Zoom, right? I've raised 5 rounds of forehand. This is the first one over Zoom. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to make it a great pitch over Zoom. Here's the only thing I know. Just do not let me talk for the whole time. You're going to get bored. So I just said it. Please ask questions. Please interrupt. And so at least that gave him also like, oh, it's okay to do that. Then like every couple slides, if somebody was asked a question, I would stop. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you think. Tell them what your questions are. Then you start just because you want them to open up. You want to be discussion. Then you kind of stop using the pitch deck or stop going in order. And you start to jump around based on where they are at. You know, I pitch now with our finance head. You know, the in person, it's much easier to make the when to go to him versus me. Mm-hmm. Over Zoom, it's harder. So we had to spend more time. So after every pitch, a suit hop on the phone and be like, what are the parts that went well? What are the parts not do well? How can we split stuff up? Anytime you try to hand stuff off over Zoom, it's harder. So we actually plan them more, right? Okay, like at this area, you're going to go. This topic, I'm going to go, right? So we didn't have to coordinate. I do think it's helpful to have like text or chat up between you and whoever else you're going to pitch just to be like, hey, can you take this part or whatever, right? Yeah. So those are some of the lessons I learned to do it via Zoom.
Was it pretty – I like all that. Did you have it pretty like, hey, I'm going to start pretty scripted out with your finance person, or was it a little more fluid or ad hoc? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't think scripting out is actually a good idea in pitch. Cause I think it comes across. Yeah. We always do dry runs. This is one thing I suggest for everybody listening to the podcast. You definitely want to do dry runs. I don't think you need to do the whole pomp and circumstance of the pitch. It's more to get feedback on the deck. And so, you know, great people to show it to. Obviously, board members, investors, always really helpful. The other thing is entrepreneurs. And I think one of the most important things I think I realized was, you know, as an early entrepreneur, I would get advice from tons of people. Yep. That's bad. Don't do that. Because if you ask 5 people for advice, they're going to have 6 different thoughts and opinions. Yep. And you're going to get lost in trying to filter and synthesize. So what I think one thing I learned the hard way, was for every stage we're at, trying to find 1 or 2 entrepreneurs that are a stage ahead of us. Mm. Now that's going to change, right? Depending on what stage you're at, but somebody who's been in your shoes about a year ago, and you show the pitch deck to them, you get advice on investors for them, because they're going to have gone through all this, right? Yep. So, you know, I would show it to them. They're going to get tons of thoughts on it. And then you'll sort of hone it. And then the first few pitches, I usually try to do it with not maybe my top choice investor, right? And somebody I still want, but not my top choice, because you're just going to hone it in. And you don't almost then need to work on a script, because what you're going to see in your first three pitches is there's going to be a couple points where every investor is going to ask you about. And when, you know, if everybody's asking about LTV to CAC, you're like, okay, I'm not doing a clear job discussing LTV to CAC, right? So I have to go back and fix that, right? And so what, however it is, you're going to learn a tremendous amount from doing the first few pitches.
Good. I won't keep you too much longer. But you know, pitching a entity like Fidelity, it's, as you mentioned, so much about metrics and finances, other than obviously what, you know, revenue, you know, per unit economics, like what kind of metrics are they really drilling into?
Beyond the obvious. At this stage of growth, right, what they're trying to figure out and get comfortable with is, hey, can this company, can it IPO, and at what price,
basically,
Because, and then, right, so that's the first thing they're figuring out. The next thing is, okay, and how big can it get? Because how much more room is there than price, right?
Yep.
So that's what they're thinking about. So they're thinking of everything from the size of the market to, you know, the economics. I mean, we had investors in this round, and, you know, this happens, you go, as you get higher and higher rounds, the investor will do more and more work. So we had investors this round get consulting firms and analysts to do work to try to understand how big our business can get, right? The teams that they'll bring on to analyze our business are often, there are more people on their team than are on our finance team, right? Because they're really trying to figure that out, right? And then where are the rooms in each metric and stat where I can adjust it? Okay, you know, on LTV, I think it can, you know, as an entrepreneur, I'll pitch that I think get up to there. The investor's going to try to do work. Can it really get up to there? Okay, well, if I don't believe him, or, you know, if it's a little bit less, do I still like it? Okay, what about growth? You know, and so they're trying to work through every line item, right?
On that, just one more question. We're almost done, but market size, is that something you're typically providing, or their analyst team is sort of trying to really understand it? Because especially with a market like yours, there are proxies for other educational things, but it's sort of blue ocean, right?
Look, this is my own belief. If an investor asks you lots of questions and is skeptical of the market size or the TAM, it's the wrong investor. Because especially at the seed stage or at the A stage, because they fundamentally don't see the opportunity. Right? And so to me, that's usually a sign that it's not the right investor. Can you convince them? Sometimes. But I actually think if an investor really harps on TAM, you're never going to convince them, because they intuitively are skeptical. And if you're an entrepreneur, the TAM is usually not clear cut, because you are trying to invent a new market. You're trying to find a new space in that market or whatever it is. So, but, you know, I also, the only way you can really believe in TAM is just faith and belief in that market and your own personal experience from it, because the only markets you can be sure of TAM are markets that are already mature and exist.
Yeah.
So for example, you know, I can tell you the market for cars, right, that exists, right? If you tell me a gas car, if you're Elon Musk and saying, okay, look, I'm doing cars, but it's if it's not using gas, I guarantee you he got people being like, well, are people really going to want that? Is there a demand for it? So, I mean, you know, part of an entrepreneur is you have to believe something that other people think is impossible. And I think early on as an entrepreneur, one of the hard parts for me is when somebody said something was impossible, I would run away from it, right? Because, maybe that's not right. What I had to learn is, no. When somebody says something's impossible, you run to it. Because that means that you see something other people don't. I believe that on the market size as well.
I like it. All right, last question. Any other tips that you'd like to share that we haven't covered, and or anything you'd give your younger self starting this process all that over again?
Question. Yeah.
Yep.
I think if I told my younger self, right, you know, started this in 2012, right, on this journey, there's a lot of doubt that comes along the way. And I think I would have tried to tell myself to be a little less hard on myself, right? Even if things work out or they don't, I'm going to have learned a tremendous amount. So I think that's probably what I would tell myself. Advice along the way, I think – you know, picking that, you know, advisor, entrepreneur that's a couple stages ahead of you, really helpful. To understanding, and this took me a while to grasp, your job as a CEO is going to change every few months, and nobody's going to tell you that it's changed or how it's changed. So you just got to be constantly prepared for personal growth and trying to be ahead of that curve as possible. And then, you know, we already talked about this, you know, parts of this, but choosing people that you want to work with. There are a lot of people in this world that are not good people. They're going to try to screw you in your business, are going to be a pain to work with. avoid those people at all costs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because life is short, you're gonna have enough issues, and then the last thing you need is somebody else who's going to be like that. Even if you try your best to avoid those people, you're gonna encounter some of those people. Do not be an ass back to them, because it's a small world. That's not how you want to live your life. Other people are gonna hear about it, and there are great people in the world. And if you try to do your best and always do the right thing, you're going to attract other people who also try to do that too.
Awesome. Really cool. Do you think you'll ever get into doing, you have a business category. Will you ever have a masterclass from, who would I want to learn from? Right. Like, you know, some startup like hero. Yeah, like, I don't know. I'd have to think about this a little bit. Like, who would I most want to learn from? I think it'd be a cool class. You think you'll get into that category?
Yeah. We have got into some entrepreneurship. We did a class with our first entrepreneurship class with the CEO and the founder of Spanx, Sarah Blakely, who is fantastic and great. That's an amazing entrepreneurship class. She was bootstrapped, right, and built that to be a huge business. There is hustle, there is grind, there is wisdom. That's a great class. On the tech side, that might be something that we go into soon. I don't know, Nathan, if you think about it, if I had to learn, from another entrepreneur, I would love a class from Elon Musk.
Sure.
I think he's done an amazing job. Jeff Bezos, Amazon, Reed Hastings. Some fantastic entrepreneurs.
Yeah, those would be interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, this is just amazing. You should see how many notes I've taken. I'm out of room, so we need to end the podcast. I have no more room for notes. Cool. If people want to learn more, it's simplymasterclass.com. And anything you want to promote or plug in the last minute or so?
Please be as safe as you can, healthy as you can, and check out our classes.
Cool. Yeah, I'm excited. All right, David, thank you so much. This is awesome.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it.
Good luck.